Thanks very much for this invitation. It's really a fascinating lineup and bringing together of disciplines and people. I'll launch into my paper. I had wanted to sort of respond to Henrietta, to a certain way of characterizing Levi-Strauss that I don't quite recognize, but I'll come back to that from my own personal point of view, maybe at the end or in the time for questions. And really what I'd like to talk about today, or I'd like to talk about two anthropological theories of symbolic efficacy, Levi-Strauss's, and I'll talk about that one quite briefly, because Stefan has done a brilliant job, actually, at summarizing that article. And I had envisaged to say much more about it, but that's quite useful, because I was short of time, so I was able to cut some of that material. But I'll make a few remarks about Levi-Strauss's theory of symbolic efficacy, and then I'd like to turn to a contemporary revision of it by another French anthropologist called Carlo Sevri, who works at the Laboratoire d'Anthropologie Sociale, which is the laboratory that Levi-Strauss himself founded. And Carlo Sevri, in fact, was one of Levi-Strauss's students, and there's a really quite fascinating dialogue going on between Carlo Sevri and Claude Levi-Strauss. And actually, as you will see, I'll get to this, Sevri shows that in a very fundamental way, Levi-Strauss's paper is flawed, and in fact, some of the premises of everything we've been saying fall away when you have a bring field experience of what happens among the Kuna, but I'll get back to that. And what I'd like to do really is pick up on the references to psychoanalysis in both their theories of symbolic efficacy, which is also a way of posing the question which Henrietta has also already really posed of the nature of the dialogue between psychoanalysis and anthropology and the nature of past forms of that dialogue, and also, more importantly, the nature of possible future forms of that dialogue. That seems to be a central core question. But the brief comments on the Levi-Strauss essay, it's dedicated, it was published in 1949, it's actually dedicated to Saussure because he uses Saussurean linguistics very freely, though, as a way of trying to understand symbolic efficacy. And Stefan has already said the way in which he shows that the shaman is doing a geography, a mythical geography that's also, he uses the phrase géographie affective, an affective geography of the patient's body, of the patient's inner body. You mentioned all of that. And the essay really describes a unique kind of language game, one in which words are aimed, as it were, directly at the patient's body. So, for example, there's the elaborate description of the feet of magical, mythical helpers walking up the way of Mu, which we know is the uterus and vagina, and which are really meant to sort of activate bodily sights. Yeah, so these words are being directed at the body and something functioning in a different way to language normally. And Stefan has also said, and this is really key to Levi-Strauss's paper, that the shaman, Levi-Strauss's idea that the shaman provides a language for the patient in which the patient can understand her pain, and it's through that the cure occurs. This is actually the element that doesn't hold up to empirical analysis. I'll get back to it. To continue this theory, he talks about really the shaman as a sort of supplier of signifiers, or rather he's sort of an assembler of floating signifiers. Floating signifiers, the phrase is Levi-Strauss's. He puts together floating signifiers with missing signifieds, in the sense that the patient knows that her pain means something, but she doesn't know what it means. And so there's a sort of disequilibrium in the relationship between signifiers and signifiers, and the shaman's intervention is supposed to be, but it's not there. And my initial comment about that is that in the light of contemporary developments in critical theory, this article published in 1949 seems an incredibly prescient analysis of the instability of signifying systems, of a sort of economy, a sort of supply and demand in the transaction of signifiers, but is usually associated with post-structuralist thought. And it also, of course, poses the core question of the relationship between language and the body, which is also traditionally thought to be the prerogative of post-structuralist thinking. Okay, so but in the context of this conference, I think what interests me more about this paper is the fact that it's framed immediately, this theory, in terms of a comparison between psychoanalysis and anthropology. And yes, he is in part critiquing Freud's notion of the unconscious, and I can get back to that in the discussion parts yes, he has this idea of an empty unconscious that is getting its materials from somewhere else. This is key to it, Yes, and Stefan has mentioned this dialogue between psychoanalysis and anthropology already. I just want to add that one of the things he does, and the comment I have to make about this dialogue, is he explores inverted symmetries. This is something that Levi-Strauss absolutely loves, inverted symmetries, and you can get a lot of mileage out of inverted symmetries. And so he explores inverted symmetries between psychoanalytic practices and ritual practices, so that, for example, in ritual, it's the shaman who speaks for his patient, whereas in analysis, through transference, it is the patient who makes the analyst speak, okay, and by leading, by lending him or her emotions. Both kinds of therapy, Levi-Strauss says, brings to the fore conflicts that are unconscious, and they're unconscious in the case of psychoanalysis because they're repressed, in the case of the cunicule because they are organic. And my point about these inverted symmetries is really that I think what matters to me about this essay is a particular style of comparatism that Levi-Strauss is introducing here. And I think this is in 1949. This is really quite daring in 1949 and quite advanced. And the aim of these inverted symmetries, of these parallels, the underlying aim is really to, in one sense, to reveal the familiar in the exotic and the exotic in the familiar, but in doing so really to challenge people's assumptions about the relative positions of self and other, so that the psychoanalyst and the shaman are no longer in a relationship of, say, civilized to primitive, but on the contrary, put on an equal playing field. So contrary to what Henrietta was saying, I would say there is a very strong ethical dimension to this paper. This is an ethical move that he's doing, and I think that move is more important, perhaps, than the content of the comparison itself that he makes. Okay. And final comments about the Levi-Strauss paper is that this way of relating anthropology to psychoanalysis recurs in Levi-Strauss's works up to the late 1950s, early 1960s, which is the period that overlaps with his friendship with Lacan, which actually came to a tragic end when one of Levi-Strauss's most brilliant students, Lucien Sebag, committed suicide whilst in analysis with Lacan. And I'm sure that actually there's a personal background to a sort of end to the dialogue between anthropology and psychoanalysis in Levi-Strauss's works. The form of this dialogue is typical of late 1950s, early 1960s, and that later on he tries to assemble the two in quite a different way, typically by playfully subsuming psychoanalytic theory under the category of mythical thought. For example, presenting Freud's quote-unquote psychosexual reading of the Oedipus myth as just one other version of that myth. Yeah. This is quite a different way of relating the two. Okay. And also, this is something I've argued elsewhere, I think Levi-Strauss changes his approaches to try and understand the unconscious and try and grasp the unconscious post-1960s, and in particular with his work on American Indian myth. There's a very different approach to the unconscious to the one that Henrietta, in a sense, was using as the basis of her critique, in which the anthropologist, in a sense, using his own unconscious mind as a sort of laboratory to understand mythical transformation. So the status of the anthropologist in relationship to this work of understanding the unconscious changes fundamentally, I think, with the start of the Mythologique, his books on American Indian myth. Okay, so moving on to Kaolo Severi. There's also, in his own recent treatment, he published a book in 2007 called Le Principe de la Chimère, the Principle of the Chimera. Kaolo Severi addresses the question of efficacy as part of his studies of ritual, which are part of a broader project that's got to do with the anthropology of memory. And Severi revisits Levi Strauss's seminal essay in this 2007 book and provides an important critique of it, but also finds a way of overcoming this, the shortcomings that he sees in this essay. And he does that in particular by drawing on the work of an Italian psychoanalyst who I think had a resonance in France in particular, Gaetano Roy, who worked with autistic children in particular. And so Severi's very sophisticated treatment of ritual efficacy, in that treatment, I'm struck he uses psychoanalysis, but I think my point about Severi really, and this is where my paper I'd like to explore further in a sense, it starts something, but it seems that the implications of what Severi writes, the psychoanalytic implications of what Severi writes, go far beyond what Severi is willing to articulate himself, and I think it's that avenue that I'm interested in exploring. Okay, so Levi Strauss's argument about the Kuhne cure was based on textual evidence, the publication of this chant. When Kaolo Severi conducted fieldwork among the Kuhne in the 1970s, starting in the 1970s, he actually discovered that the shaman's chant is in fact sung in an esoteric language that is almost incomprehensible to his patient. So she may have understood isolated phrases or words, and she knew the broad lines of the story that the shaman tells from tradition, as does every Kuhne, but the song would have been essentially experienced as meaningless sounds. And it follows that Levi Strauss's argument to the effect that the shaman provides a language in which the patient is able to verbalize states that she cannot herself verbalize doesn't work as described. So how does Severi get beyond this obstacle and himself account for the efficacy of the cure? There are really two lines of argument that stand out. And I'm summarizing quite a complex sort of argument. The one relating to the ways in which the shaman uses his voice, intonations, rhythms, etc., and the other to the role of images and of certain forms of perception, visual or auditory, in these cures. And these two lines of argument both pertain to a larger question, which has got to do, which goes to the core of the question of symbolic efficacy, which is that of the nature of the belief, kind of belief, that binds shaman and patient in their own version of the clinical dyad. Let us start with the thematics of voice, which are crucial to Severi's analysis. In his account of ritual efficacy, it is not so much what is being said, or even the type of language used that matters, but how it is said and used. Rituals, such as the Kuhne cure, he argues, rely on a particular use of language in which the focus shifts to the act of enunciation. And this is at the expense of the message itself. Those kinds of rituals, in other words, bring to the fore the pragmatic dimensions of communication. Excuse me. And they moreover transform ordinary daily pragmatics, he says, by transforming the identity of the enunciator. He's really trying to grasp a specifically ritual context of communication, and he's trying to explain ritual efficacy by explaining a specifically ritual context of communication. And so this ritual context has got to do with enunciation and the transformation of the enunciator. And in particular, in ritual, in the Amerindian rituals that he himself studied, the shaman takes on what he calls a complex identity, quote unquote. And there are many ways in which this happens. So in the Mu Igala, for example, there's a preamble to this chant, which narrates in the present tense the visit of the midwife, who reveals that her patient has taken on the warm coat of illness. It narrates the shaman's own visit to see the patient. It narrates his minute ritual preparations up to the very moment where he starts to sing. This part of the song is constructed on odd temporal paradoxes. The shaman is singing that the shaman is about to start singing. And these paradoxes, according to Severi, serve a purpose, which is to confer upon the shaman a dual identity, and by extension, to create parallel realities. So there's the shaman in the here and now singing, and there's the shaman who is a protagonist in his own song. So they're two shamans. Fundamentally, this is, I think, one of Severi's original proposals regarding belief. This dual identity entertains doubt in the patient's mind, or maybe anxiety in analytic terms, about who the shaman is and whether his transformations are effective or not, and whether he'll be able to do it again. For Severi, for Severi's argument about belief is that it is fundamentally anchored in doubting. It proceeds from doubt. The belief in supernatural beings, for example, is not subjectively experienced as a certainty that supernatural beings exist, but more as an inability to say for sure that they don't exist. And many rituals, he notes, are discussed after the event and give rise to questions about what has exactly happened. Severi puts this doubt at the very core of symbolic efficacy, the creation of this doubt in the protagonist at the very core of symbolic efficacy. The Kuna use another song, which is called the Nia Igala, which is used to cure lakura, or madness. And the Kuna believe that madness is the result of an attack on human beings by the jaguar of the sky. And the victim gradually starts to behave like this supernatural predator. And he becomes an incarnation of this pathogen spirit. And the shaman responds by embarking on a counterattack, a symbolic hunt for the evil spirit. Crucially, in order to combat the chimera that is the jaguar of the sky, the jaguar of the sky is quite often thought of as a bird with a jaguar's voice. The shaman must himself become a kind of chimera. What this means in practical terms is that he must transform his voice. As Severi writes, he must take, quote-unquote, this is my translation, a complex voice, a voice within which a whole range of different creatures may be evoked, some of them potentially enemy. At the start of the cure, the shaman is initially identified with vegetal spirits, such as the balsa tree, and the enemy jaguar is animal. However, once the shaman has found the jaguar, it is upon him that the task falls of representing the fearful animal spirits, construed as coming from the body of his patient. As Severi puts it, the shaman's voice opens itself to the echoes of the cries of animal spirits. These analyses reveal how, in an Amerindian context, the act of enunciating transforms the enunciator. Severi describes the shaman's ritual identity using borrowing from psychoanalysis, and calls the shaman's identity a quote-unquote condensed identity. But it seems to me, and this is why I'd like to go beyond what Severi is saying, that what he describes goes beyond condensation. It's the dynamics of transference that this ritual seemed to evoke, albeit in a transposed form, so that the shaman's voice, as described by Severi, quite literally assimilates the voice of animal spirits, which are for the patient menacing incarnations of death and madness, or perhaps one might also say of fearful inner objects. The split-off part of the shaman that has become a protagonist in his own story is a substitute for figures belonging to the patient's experience. discussing the transformation of the identity of the shaman during the ritual and by means of the ritual, Severine notes, his identity, the shaman's identity, is created cumulatively by a gradual inclusion of traits belonging to one pole of the opposition, the patient jaguar, under the sphere of influence of the other, the plant shaman. It is a sort of introjection of one by the other. Excuse me, I'm just going to... and revealingly, Severi compares the shaman's voice to an auditory mask, which he uses to create new identities, and indeed identities that are paradoxical or conflicted with one another, his at once animal spirit and plant spirit. Another feature of the ritual described above that resonates with transference is its creation and use of a complex space, and one that is at once real and symbolic. The same applies to the analytic setting. Here too, the physical environment can become something else, a body, for example, as notes psychoanalyst, is it Simon Akhtar? Yeah, Simon Akhtar, in a paper from 2009, where he writes about the ground on which ground floor offices are sometimes located as inviting, as particularly inviting an association with a reassuring parental body. Similarly, Akhtar discusses the wall against which some analysts' couches are placed as a supporting arm. More generally, the shaman's voice seems to fulfill a similar containing and holding function as does the analytic space. Let us now look at the question of the relation between images and belief and what Severi has to say about their contribution to the efficacy of symbols. And Severi's argument here involves a journey through a wide range of examples from across cultures and historical epochs before he returns to the cunicure. Severi is interested in seemingly marginal popular beliefs that persist over time or recur seemingly without explanation. And one such belief was held by many Benandanti. The term literally means good walkers and describes farmers from the Friuli district of northern eastern Italy, who during the 16th and 17th centuries claimed to travel out of their bodies while asleep to fight malevolent witches in order to ensure good crops for the season to come. They were thought of as heretics by the Roman Inquisition. And Severi is interested in the nature of the beliefs held by the Benandanti and their dissemination. And often individuals claimed to have become Benandanti as the result of a traumatic experience, itself usually linked to the perception of an intense image, such as the apparition of a strange animal. The particular belief that interests Severi relates to the return of a Benandante soul after a Sabbath. The return of a Benandante soul to its sleeping body after a Sabbath. The belief, should the body have been changed, should the body have changed position, or should someone have changed the position of the body, it was said, the soul would no longer be able to find an orifice to re-enter the body, and the Benandante would die. Severi's main point is that the belief in witches in 16th and 17th century Italy didn't spread by means of the transmission of a coherent belief system, but by the hold that certain images, as this one, had on the imagination of believers. And I think this is you, Darren, making a similar point about the image of the dead child. Maybe there's something similar here. Believing for Severi is not propositional, but visual. It depends on a projection, his term, of images. In effect, the ability of certain images to give rise to other images on the basis of certain special features. In the case of the image of the Benandante soul trying to re-enter its body, it is the juxtaposition of quotidian with the supernatural, of a man sleeping in bed with witches, that explains the force of this particular image. The image works, Severi analyzes, by means here also of a tension created by that juxtaposition. The banal detail of a man sleeping provides, as he put it, a sort of slit through which the listeners can imaginatively enter a supernatural world. In another example, Severi turns to sorry, in another example, Severi turns to the many stories surrounding the legend of the man-eating wolf known as the Beast of Gévaudan. The wolf is supposed to have been real and is supposed to have killed, in particular, many women and children between 1764 and 1767. And what strikes Severi here again are seemingly unimportant details in the reiteration of that story. So the beast was often thought to belong to a unique species of wolves, of which there were supposed to be only two individuals. And this helped explain that the beast could appear simultaneously in two different places. It's part of the story surrounding the beast's attacks. But looking more closely at these popular beliefs, it turns out that many legends often speak about three, not two, wolves, the third wolf remaining completely unknown to man. It is an animal, as accounts have it, that is always still, as it were, unaccounted for. The third wolf plays a crucial role in Severi's analysis of the enduring hold that this story has had on popular imagination, and hence of its symbolic efficacy. It is a crucial narrative blank or empty space which any listener to the story can use as a point of departure for his or her new interpretations of that story. Severi's account of belief focuses on a particular psychological relationship to images, a relationship that places a sort of psychical working over at the core of the response to those images. These images share certain distinctive features. In the examples given above, they're constructed around either a banal detail or, on the contrary, around an unknowable element. These are essentially lacunary images and, as such, associated with the creation of a certain tension and anxiety in their beholders. But here, too, ritual and night psychoanalysis seem to echo one another beyond what Severi is willing to say. Many analysts have related how sometimes patients suddenly notice an image present in the analyst's office, which they had previously overlooked, no doubt because of some connection to the ongoing analytic situation. Often, the patient, in fact, believes to be seeing the image for the first time, even when that is not the case. Beyond this role of images in the analytic setting, Severi's approach to the role of images in belief recalls Edgar Allan Poe's famous 1844 story, The Purloined Letter, which Lacan famously took up and read as a sort of fable of the analytic process. The compromising letter, stolen from the royal boudoir by a minister, is deliberately left on the minister's desk in full view, but remains invisible, at least initially, because it looks like any other letter. Lacan will argue that this letter, also a blind spot or empty space, reveals to each of its successive possessors their unconscious. Severi uses the above notion of images acting as a screen or blank space to propose his own interpretation of the symbolic efficacy of the Kuna chant. Okay, thanks. In childbirths. As I've mentioned, the Kuna chant is problematic for empirical reasons. The patient doesn't understand what the shaman is saying. Severi turns to Gaetano Roy and his work with autistic children in a village called Asso near Milano, and to his musical, this is, I think it developed in the 1950s actually, to his idea of a musical mode of listening to the speech of autistic children. He discovered that these children were using involuntary noises, truncated or fused expressions, exclamations, etc., in fact, in a coherent and systematic way, as an alternative mode of communication. They were not able to use words according to their accepted semantic content, but they found a way of putting to use other purely auditory features of language. They had, as it were, twisted sounds and tones to fit another pattern, bringing to the fore in the process another language within language, one that is evocative of poetic practices, actually, Dadaist sound poems, symbolist poetics. I could say more about this. Viewing Kuna ritual through these analytic insights, Severi proposes to also approach the shaman's chant as a sound image divorced from the meaning of words, or at least it is as such an acoustic image that its patient is likely to have apprehended. She knows that the chant means something, but she cannot follow precisely what the shaman is saying. She recognizes some words, is guided by the shaman's voice, and Severi concludes that this chant, this wall of sound, is itself a blank screen, although this time auditory, and its symbolic efficacy comes from the necessity it creates in the patient to project her own visualizations onto it. As Severi puts it, during the course of the performance of the shamanistic chant, the basic episodes of a mythical story known to everyone start to emerge in fragments. These appear within a neutral soundscape, which, secret and incomprehensible, constitutes a projective space for the patient. In the end, it is the way in which the ritual requires a psychic and perceptive work on behalf of the patient that is presented as the explanation of its efficacy. So the true author of the chant and the cure is the patient herself. Have I got time to talk about these images? I probably need another 10 minutes. Is that in the final part of... Is that okay? Right.
Do you have the right image behind you?
I do, but do I have my notes with me is what I'm wondering. Is someone sitting on some... Do you mind? Sorry, my apologies. I hope this is not going to come embarrassing. Here it is. Okay, so briefly and by way of a conclusion, I'd like to reverse this perspective. I've been looking, in a way, at anthropological material psychoanalytically, and I'd like to look at psychoanalysis anthropologically now, very briefly, and I'd like to do that through these rather wonderful photographs made by a photographer who is also himself a psychoanalyst, Mark Gerard, who is New York-based. And this is an ongoing project, and he has so far 55 photographs of analysts in America, France, England. And his idea is to create a sort of representative sample of analysts in the 21st century and their offices. And he's interested, obviously, in his subject is the analytic office. And I'm, first of all, of course, interested in his focus on space, which is a very anthropological question. And where he's coming from is a particular sense of threat. He fears that modern life, Skype, sessions that take place over telephone are, in a sense, threatening the analytic space, that they are in risk of disrupting what he calls, using Jung, the secure, continuous, containing space that the analytic office is supposed to be. And I find these photos fascinating as an analyst representation not only of other analysts, but actually of the analytic process, and really as such, in anthropological terms, as a sort of indigenous representation, you know, indigenous representation of one's own practices. I'll just pick up on some details. And so, this is the first image, Annie Bergman. And many images really bring out this quality of the office as screen. So as you can see, I mean, she's actually here completely merged with her office. But many of these offices are completely enclosed spaces. Could I have the second image, as is this photograph of Elizabeth Mayer. And the first thing that struck me about these photographs is the way that they signaled a sort of transition from a social space to another kind of space, which is also ritually important. More deeply, what these photographs do so well, I think, is really capture the tension between two kinds of spaces, not the ones I've just been talking about, two other kinds of spaces, which is really the space of the physical space of the office itself and analytic space, immaterial analytic space. And this is quite a difficult challenge for a photographer. How could you photograph analytic space? And I think one of the ways in which he does this recurringly, if I could have the next photograph of Felix Ringstrom, is that he almost systematically photographs a sort of counter-use of the analytic space. He shows analysts doing absolutely everything except analyzing, as here he's engaged in lively conversation. Could I have the next photograph, please? Jill here in meditation. And the next photograph, please. And this is a frequent trope throughout these photographs, the analyst on his own couch. The point being is, in a sense, the space is continually counter-used or used differently. The analyst is in the couch or somewhere else doing something else. And in a sense, this is, through absence, signaling what is not being represented, which is the analytic process itself, which stands as something sort of sacred and unrepresentable in the middle of these photographs. Could I have the next photograph, please? I'm also very interested in the presence of Freud in these images, here in sublimated form, behind Irene Engelman. And the next photograph, the one next, please. And here in book form with Bob Weinstein. Gerald notes how many analysts actually tried to imitate the mood and tone of Freud's office and preserve just up the street. And tried to imitate it. And there is a certain relationship to temporality that seems anthropologically significant in the images and in the way in which Freud is present in these photographs. My main point about that really is that these photographs made me think that psychoanalysis has its own complex inner spaces, temporalities of the patient or the analytic cure, but is itself caught up in culturally fabricated temporalities of another order and are part of performing those temporalities. And one of those has got to do, as in many of these photographs, in particular those that show offices that are sort of imitating Freud's, with a need for the past to be preserved in a present form. And in a way, that's what the Freud Museum and Freud's couch in the Freud Museum, I think, is also about, creating a particular kind of temporality that within which the temporality of psychoanalysis takes place. In this particular case, again, the key point is the need to give physical existence to the past through the object, which is Freud's couch. I mean, presumably, it would be the same to look at one might think it would be the same to look at the photograph of the couch as opposed to going to see it. But it's the need to have it palpably there, potentially touchable. The current exhibition plays with the idea of DNA collected from that couch, and therefore all of us sort of commingling with Freud's patients, the rat man, and so forth. I have creating a particular form of presence of the past in which we can participate. And so this is a form of temporality within which psychoanalysis is embedded. That's my conclusion. I made one final concluding remark, which is that throughout both Severy and Levi-Strauss's account of symbolic efficacy, there's a constant return to aesthetics and to aesthetic questions. And Levi-Strauss talks about narrative closure, Severy about poetry and sound in poetry. And it seems to me that aesthetics is the sort of, as of yet, missing disciplinary guest in this dialogue between psychoanalysis and anthropology, and that it's revealing that psychoanalysis and anthropology are discussing symbolic efficacy, in order to do so, they need aesthetics, and they always need aesthetics. And of course, this project, the Gerald Photography Project, is at once aesthetics and therapy for himself, a way of creating a space in which he can contain the anxiety-provoking transformations in analysis in photographic form. So reveal a sort of aesthetic form of the symbolic function and symbolic efficacy. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Boris. I have questions, but I just wanted to throw it open to the audience first to see if anyone had particular questions for Boris.
It's not really a question, but it's a burning desire to say something that I've been struck by. I'm a storyteller and a trainee drama therapist, and I was suddenly struck by the notion of the ritual threshold, which we use a lot in drama therapy, and the connection that I'm now making to symbols that clients bring into that space. And I don't really know why I'm saying this, but I think I want something more to think about because it feels very exciting. It's allowing me to think about ritual thresholds in a why they change, the symbols that are present, why they're so important, and the nature of the therapeutic space, I suppose, and the way in which drama therapists work, which is not in an office, but might be in several different places, and how we sort of take our office with us, and how that ritual is. I think that's it.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you're saying, and I think you've actually put your finger on quite an important aspect, both of Levi-Strauss's essay and Severy's essay, which has got to do with the creation of thresholds and linking the efficacy of the cure to the creation of thresholds. So during the Cuna cure, the shaman alternates between describing kind of mythical sites and then describing bodily sites. He alternates quicker and quicker as a sort of way of, in a way, create. I mean, that the ritual is performative, so the argument would be from that of a certain borderline between the mythical and the bodily and the psychical, and yes, and creates a tension around that borderline. I think that's Severy is particularly picking up on the tension element of that. And the image of the Benandante sleeping, the quotidian next to the witch, the sleeping body next to the Sabbath, is also about a borderline and the importance of some kind of borderline in the efficacy of images as well. So I think that's a very important theme. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, from the very end of your talk, the aesthetic form of the symbolic affection. So I'd like to learn a little more about it, because coincidentally, you asked about anthropologists or psychoanalysts around in the room, people from architecture here, and coincidentally, the one who started to develop the idea of the aesthetic setting, the aesthetic of a setting in psychoanalysis, happened to be the youngest son of Freud, who was an architect and who designed the redevelopment of the Queen's Anne's House that is now the Freud Museum. But also, for example, Melanie Klein's consulting room in London was designed by him. So I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but not only this caught my attention, but also the idea of what Lou Andrea Salomé, and this is what my question comes, Lou Andrea Salomé would say that the erotic would be suspended between the physical and the spiritual, in her words. And from what you said, I would say that it could be suspended between the physical and the psychical. Mm-hmm. So the worry we have about losing psychoanalysis as a space for this interaction, this affective interaction that seems to be historically being lost. So, and it seems to be reflected in this worry about losing the space for it. Mm-hmm. So how do you elaborate it, and if you put Lou Andrea Salomé somehow in this discussion?
I'm not sure I know how to put Lou Andrea Salomé into this discussion, but I get the impression that certainly Mark Gerald's photographic work is about the transformations of the aesthetics of the space, the aesthetics of the space that is the analytic setting in a broader sense. And I feel that there's a history of that aesthetics of space, of spaces, which has got to do also with the idea of creating moods and when it starts to be possible to create. I mean, there's a lot of reference to atmospheres, objects, matter in a very particular way in the description of these analytic settings. And these are all, I think, historical forms of a particular kind of symbolism, in your case, linked to architecture and space, which is also... I think that Gerald's anxiety about transition may be in part an anxiety about the change in the nature of the aesthetic symbolism, which with internet and social media, new forms of technologies are maybe moving away from a particular kind of mood-based aesthetic to something else. I don't know, possibly something like that. Mm-hmm. And colour is always very important. A lot of analysts write about the colours that they need on their wall, which are conducive to an analytic frame of mind, which again, to my mind, is basically a 19th century idea of symbolism. That's post-symbolist in the sense of French symbolist poets. It's post-Mallarmé. It's kind of, it's because of them that, in part, was summarizing, that form of symbolism came about.
Okay, well, I'm told we can have more questions for Boris at the plenary. Maybe I could just ask a quick question just to underscore something very important that you brought to our attention, is that with Severi and others have pointed out that the patient doesn't understand the secret language of the shaman. I'm trying then to understand both an explanation for the specific design features of the song, which relate to the problem that the patient is experiencing, and the specific effect on the patient when there's this gap between the symbolic structure and what the patient is hearing. I see a few different possibilities. Maybe it's a completely a magical incantation that the shaman is just speaking with the spirits and doesn't care that the patient doesn't understand. Maybe once upon a time the language wasn't a secret language that was distorted so other people couldn't understand it, but there was this symbolic efficacy that was there. And I'm also intrigued when you say that the patient knows certain words coming through and also the general structure of the shape of the story. And then I'm thinking maybe the Catholic listening to the Latin Mass and picking out certain things that trigger that.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do you see that?
I think the question of the gap is precisely the one that... the gap is what Severi uses to explain the efficacy, in the sense that he's proposing that the patient is reacting to the sounds as inherently meaningful, and that there's a production of meaning in the manipulation of sound forms, which actually completely divorced from the meaning of words, could be made to parallel bodily processes, and are sufficiently usable to invite the patient to create her own parallel story from those elements, or reconstruct her own story from those elements, and specifically that it's the active role in the patient in sort of reconstructing that story precisely on the basis of something that's deficient, that lacks meaning, that is powerful, that is efficacious symbolically. Hence this idea, in a sense, of the shaman's words as a sort of blank, as a sound image, but nevertheless with structures, but which the patient can nevertheless project herself onto. Which is also what is providing, in a sense, a link with psychoanalysis and
interpretation.
Yes. Yep.
We have to move on, but just one point. Levi Strauss wrote the program notes for the 1972 Bayreuth Festival,
Okay, of course, yes.
Which is a cut, and of course through music, and when you were speaking, it was like going to the opera, isn't it? You don't really get it, you know. And you've got, but anyway.
Read the libretto.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Boris. And,